identification purposes only. This is a talk given by Mike Eshelman of the Northwestern Group of Alcoholics Anonymous on the night of September the 27th, 1951. Mike was the first member of Alcoholics Anonymous in the city of Detroit after Detroit's founder.
I'm about to tell hasn't changed very much over the years. However, I hope before I leave that I may impart to some man that was afflicted with this same disease as I myself some ray of hope, some message, some word, or some thought that he too may enjoy the happiness and peace and contentment that it's been my lot to enjoy as a member of this wonderful organization of ours. December of 1934, there was a man laying ill in a New York hospital. He was a hopeless alcoholic. He had tried every means of recovery known to the medical science. Finally, as he lay this day in desperate despair and despondency and hopelessness, he thought of one more thing that he might do, and he said, "If there be a God, let him show himself to me now." And this man testified further that from that moment on, it seemed as though light, the room was completely filled with the most brilliant light. That he felt as though Atlas must have felt if someone had removed the earth from his shoulders. He felt elated about it. Seemed as though in this room that he was occupying that a great wind was gradually swooshing through there. And this wind was swooshing through this man. And this man knew, he said, beyond any question of a doubt, that he was then in the presence of Almighty God. And he knew further that that obsession of drink had been removed from him for all time. And he turned to the physician that was attending him, a most prominent physician, a man who at that time and down through the years up until he passed away this last year was recognized as one of the finest and one of the best informed on alcoholism of our time. No less a person than Dr. Silkworth. And he turned to Dr. Silkworth and said, "Have I lost my mind?" And the good doctor said, "No, you haven't lost your mind. But, he said, "I don't know what has happened to you, but whatever has happened to you, hang on to it, take it, and pass it on to your fellow man, because you well can have the answer within your grasp of this alcoholic problem that we have been working so many years with." The man I'm referring to is Bill Wilson, the founder of this wonderful organization of ours. And as you all know, Bill went later to Akron and teamed up with Dr. Bob. And they together formulated this program of ours. And in the formulation of that program, they gave to us 12 steps. The 12 steps, the rule and guide of our conduct in AA. Those 12 steps are the things that I want to talk about tonight. I want to, in my humble way, to tell you folks how by the use of them I have had sobriety over the last 11 years. I'm not going to delve too much into my sordid and colored escapade with John Barleycorn, other than to tell you, for the benefit of some that hasn't heard, that I wrestled with old John for 30 years, and he finally gave me an awful threshing. And I found myself, a little over 11 years ago, in a most terrible position. I found myself living in a world that was awfully dark, but it was full of despair and discouragement and distress and name it. And it was full of that. And I sat in a gin mill not two blocks from a home that I had a small equity in, and a wife that was looking after that home in which I had a smaller equity. A wife that it mattered not when or how I got home, had been there looking after this thing and, as it were, keeping the home fires burning. A wife that cooked many meals that I didn't get home to eat. A wife that it didn't make any difference how long I had been absent from this home, was there waiting for the guy to come home that she thought she married about 19 years ago. I always like to mention that because I like to take my hat off to the gals that saw fit to hang on and take the terrible mental beating that we fellas gave them in the face of utter despair, hang on to something that, we couldn't have, in the face of the thing, we couldn't have possibly stood the gap like these gals did. Only to be an instrument by which, when we found ourselves trying to overcome this disease of ours, that was the right-hand power, the one that we could lean on and expect some help from and get. You girls have played a most important part in the success of this organization of ours known as Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat in this gin mill and with those conditions that I've just told you and meditated with myself whether or not I was going home to these two small equities that I had or whether I would go down on Michigan Avenue and cast my lot in with the boys down there. I didn't go to Michigan Avenue for the same reason that any other drunk never accepts the responsibility until he has to. I had a crutch that I thought I could lean on. And I went home to that crutch. And I asked this little gal if she'd give me a lift out of this deal that I was in, and her answer was, no. You got into it, you'll have to get out the best way you can. Now, that was the smartest thing that she ever told me. And the reason it was the smartest thing that she ever told me was that I knew the chips were all down then. I knew that I'd come to the end of the line, that I'd been caught off base, and that whether I liked it or not, if I didn't do something about this problem of mine, Michigan Avenue, it was going to be either that or death or an insane asylum. I knew that just as sure as the day follows the night. So I remembered 4 short months before of seeing a pal of mine that had been sent to Akron to be given a cure, they told me then. And I saw this man leave Detroit in a most deplorable condition. His shoulders were stooped and his head was bowed and his hands were shaking and his eyes were blurry and his face was flushed and he was a broken man if I ever saw one. And I saw him return in less than 2 weeks' time from Akron, an entirely changed person. Shoulders were straight and his head was up and those eyes were cleared and the flesh had left his face and his hands had lost its shake and He seemed to have been an entirely changed personality. I recognized that in this man. And I sent for him. And he came. And he brought me this program, the same as you fellows have gone out on every call you've gone. And he told me about these 12 steps. The big book hadn't been written yet. The 12 steps were formulated and were in transcript form. But he knew them because they had taught them to him down in Akron. And he explained them to me, as I'm going to explain them to you and tell you how I have made them work for me over these years of so much happiness. He said that I had to admit that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. Not too much of a job for me to admit that I was powerless over alcohol because I used to be able to carry a pretty good package. And I found myself in the last, I'd imagine 5 years of my drinking where I was absolutely uncontrollable when I got a full head of steam on. I didn't know where I was going or what I was doing. I could get no more spark out of it. It didn't make any difference how much I drank. I could just drink until I became completely saturated, and then there wasn't anything to do but crawl away and suffer one out. While we're on that subject, it was never my privilege to sober up any other way but the hard way. And some of you fellas that's had to do it that way all the time know what I'm talking about. And I know of no other thing on the face of the earth that it takes more courage to do than for a guy to come off of a drunk after he's been on one for about 6 or 8 weeks and finally decides that he's got to shake it off. Our good and well-meaning friends tells us that if we had a little willpower, we could take care of this. No, that isn't the answer. Bill Wilson laid his finger on the answer when he lay in that hospital over there in New York 17 years ago. And that's the thing I want to talk about. And that's the thing I found in this program. And that is the only thing that I attribute my sobriety to. But this fellow saw fit to formulate these 12 wonderful steps and pass them on down to us. And while we're on that subject, I feel a keen responsibility as being the recipient of these 12 steps that I continue to pass this message on as long as the Lord sees fit to keep me able to do it. I think it's a heritage that we can't take lightly and that we have to pass it on to the other fellow. And I'm always reminded when I'm thinking of these things of the thing that our dear friend Bob said, the last thing that he said almost when he talked to us in Cleveland here just before he died, and he said, "This thing's awful simple." He said you could reduce it to two words, love and service. He said, let's keep it that way. Let's don't louse it up. And that's the way I feel tonight. I feel it's just the most simple thing that was most ever organized for anyone. It isn't hard. There isn't a thing hard in it. But of course, it remains today the same as it did 17 years ago when Bill Wilson first talked to his first man. It remains the same as this fellow told me 11 years ago when he said to me, "You've got to admit that you're powerless over alcohol and that your life has become unmanageable. And you've got to have a burning desire to do something about your problem." And with a desire on your part, with a firm desire on your part to do something about your problem, we have the answer. And I had that desire. I didn't like that world I was living in. I had just been fired from a position of trust and responsibility that I'd held down for almost 20 years, only to be thrown out in the middle of the street on account of being a common, ordinary drunk. And I didn't like that. And they weren't too easy when they did it to me. Oh, I know. Some will say, "Well, you had no business drinking so much." I had no choice in the matter. I was an alcoholic. I was a sick man. I was allergic to alcohol. And that's what this good doctor has recognized. And this doctor, this same Dr. Silkworth, has passed this information on down the line, and the medical profession has recognized that we people that are obsessed with this desire to drink, that it is a disease, and that it just isn't someone bent on hellfire and damnation. So I took that step. There wasn't any question in my mind back there years ago but what I was powerless over alcohol. I knew that my life had become unmanageable because, as I have just already told you, I lost everything that was near and dear to a sane man's way of existence. And then the man said to me that I had to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. So I had no idea I was insane at that time until I began to reflect on some of the things that I had done. And I reasoned that nobody but an insane man would take a good healthy body and a good clean mind, such as I had been endowed with, and due to it the things that I had been guilty of doing to this mind and body of mine through the excessive use of alcohol. No one would take a position of trust and responsibility and treat it like I treated my position. No one would treat their friends like I treated mine. No one would go up to the altar and take a girl by the hand and promise to love and obey and then treat her the way I treated my gal for 19 years. You just don't do those things if you're sane. Sure, I took that step. I come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I knew nothing of this power that they talk about. But a little later on, they told me that I could choose to call that thing anything I wanted to. Because they said I had to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to God, as I understood it. Now, they didn't say what kind of a God that was, and it made sense to me then, and it has ever since. It's made sense to me because they didn't tell me which channel I had to go down through in order to obtain this sobriety that we was working for. They didn't say that it had to be a Protestant God or a Mohammedan God or a Catholic God or any kind. They just said a God of some kind. And that made sense. And of course, when this fellow came to me that night, he knew the route that I'd been traveling, and he knew that I knew nothing about God, because you don't find him in the blind pigs and the gin mills that I'd been frequenting all these 30 years. I didn't know anything about God. My conception of God was that fellow with long whiskers that I got back there on my mother's knee. But this fellow brought a most helpful bit of literature along with him that night when he come to see me. It was the Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox. And he said, read this, and it'll answer these questions that are going to be confusing to you to get started in this deal. He said, you're going to want to know something about the spiritual way of life. He said, Emmett Fox will tell you the easy way. And he left that book with me, and although I could hardly hold it in my hands, I was so shaky. I read the book completely through. I think that was one of the biggest lifts, along with all the other things that he gave me that night. Because along about then, he said to me, you know, if you're going to embrace this program, you've taken your last drink. I said, do you mean to tell me I can't drink again as long as I live? And he said, that's right. He said, you're allergic to alcohol. You can't take a drink as long as you live, but don't let that throw you. He said, we have an easy way of doing this. He said, we just work on a 24-hour basis. He said, we get up in the morning and we have a quiet time. That's the time, he said, when we talk to this power that's greater than ourselves, this God that we agreed to turn our will and our lives over to. And he said, we ask this God to just keep us from taking a drink for the next 24 hours. And if we have a desire to take a drink through the day, we remember that we've turned our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood him, and we ask him to help us over this hump. And then when the day is done, having had sobriety for that period, we get down on our knees and thank Almighty God for the blessings that it's been our privilege to enjoy. And we start the next day the same way. And he said a good way to start that day and to have that quiet time is with a little booklet that we call the Upper Room. He said, so some people use other booklets. It doesn't make any difference. You don't have to use the upper room. But he said, you should have some form, some regular form of service that you have in the morning before you start the day. And he said the procedure in Akron is to get a little booklet, either the upper room or one like it, and that has a scriptural reading from the Bible, and it has a body there where it explains this little reading that you've just read in the Bible, and then it has a thought for the day, and it has a prayer for the day. And he said, you take that and do that and start your day every day that way, and don't think about tomorrow. Don't worry about tomorrow, because tomorrow isn't there. Don't fret about yesterday, because that's gone. He said, the only thing we're interested in is just this 24-hour period that we're living. And he said, we've got fellows down there at Akron that's been sober 4 and 5 years on just that principle. There weren't very many of them, of course, at that time, because there was less than 100 people. But he said, all these fellows have done this thing just on these principles that I'm talking to you about. And I'm sure that if you'll try them, you're going to have sobriety the same as they have. And I can stand up here tonight and tell you that the fellow knew just exactly what he was talking about, because I haven't used any other method, only that. And that's the one that's worked. Just 24 hours at a time. I know that if I'd have started in to stay sober for a year, I'd have been thrown before the first 6 months was up. But it was just 24 hours. Well, after I'd been in the deal a little while and was having this quiet time every morning, and this little wife of mine, I didn't go to her and tell her that I'd joined Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't tell her that things were going to be different. I didn't tell her that I was going to be home every night, but she saw that I was. And the holidays were coming along, and I wasn't spoiling any more then. And I was home every night in the week. Through the weekend, got up and went to work every day. She saw something had happened, and she used to see me go to the bathroom every morning with the upper room and the Bible. And she said, what do you do in there with the Bible in the upper room? And I said, I have a quiet time. She said, don't you think it'd be a good thing if we had one together? I said, yes. And I'd lived with that girl 19 years, and it was until then that I knew I was living with a Christian woman. That's how much I knew about the gal I was living with. I was so busy with old John Barleycorn and Mike that I couldn't look at the other half of the family. Well, at any rate, she said, don't you think it's a good idea if we have this together? And I said, yes. And we started in back there. Oh, it's been a good many years ago. I guess probably 10. And we haven't missed in the morning. We have that before we have our coffee. And we had a little prayer we learned later on, and I want to pass that on to you tonight, because I've always given in my talk, because I can put a guarantee along with this thing that if you'll accept this prayer in the morning with your quiet time, I'll guarantee you that you're buying the greatest amount of insurance against not only taking a drink but having any trouble for the next 24 hours. One morning she says it, and the next morning I repeat it. It goes like this. Lord, in the quiet of this morning hour, we come to thee for peace, for wisdom, for power to view the world a day through love-filled eyes. Be patient, understanding, gentle, wise, to see beyond what seems to be, and know thy children as thou knowest them, and so not but the good in anyone behold. Make deaf our ears to slander that is told. Silence our tongues to aught that is unkind. Let only thoughts that bless dwell in our mind. Let us so kindly be, so full of cheer, that all we meet may feel thy presence near. Oh, clothe us in thy beauty, just we pray. Let us reveal thee, Lord, through all the day. I can commend that to you for your morning prayer. You'll find it, I imagine, in your library. If you can't, your librarian can get it, because it's printed on card form. There's lots of AA people use it. Well, then this fellow told me that I had to make a searching and fearless moral inventory. And that's when I took a look at my Kesselman, and that's where I found out how much out of gear he was. But then he said, You know, this program is predicated on absolute honesty. Well, he didn't need to go any farther. That one item alone was enough to keep me busy and has for all these years. Of course, I've worked on the other irregularities in my makeup, but the honesty end of the deal was the thing that, if when he told me I'd dare not take a drink again, if that didn't throw me, I was sure that this one was going to, because he was talking to a fella that over a period of years had lived pretty shadily. He was talking to one of these big shots that was perfectly content to have his wife go out and be gainfully employed over a period of 19 years and know how much money she was making every month, but he wouldn't tell her how much he was making. He was a big shot. You see, he didn't dare to tell her how much he was making, because if he did, there wouldn't be anything to drink on. And drink he must. She was living with a guy that she couldn't send to the store with a dollar bill and expect to get the right change back. I used to lie when the truth had served better. I used to lie just to keep in practice. And here comes a guy and tells me that I've got to scrap all this and start leveling with everyone I come to, and that I've got to make a searching inventory of this makeup of mine and start correcting all of those things. It looked like a tremendous job. I guess it was. Now I suppose that there's those in the audience that say, well, I guess the guy's gone soft. I guess he's a pantyweight. Not on your life. Let me tell you something. That the only thing that we alcoholics do when we take this fearless and searching moral inventory is to take a look at a guy that's got all out of gear, that's warped, and that there's something has to be corrected. And when we correct those things that are wrong with us, we're only doing the things that we know are right to do, and it's just normal to do that. So the only thing we're doing when we get into this deal and try to clean up some of that dirty mess of ours is that we're trying to live like normal people. It just isn't normal for a man to go out and stay away from his home, as it was my practice to do, for a week or 10 days without his wife knowing where he was. It isn't normal for a man like me to drink to the point where his company had to throw him out in the middle of the street because he wasn't carrying out his end of the program. It isn't normal for a man to treat his friends like I treated my friends. And it isn't normal to do a lot of things that I did. So all on earth that I'm doing, and as I stand up here tonight, the only thing I'm trying to do is to normalize myself. And there isn't any halo up there. And there won't be. And I'll still be working on it if I live to be 100 years old. And I'm awful proud of it. Proud that I belong to this outfit. Proud because of the principles that it stands for. Proud because we are a guiding influence in this world of ours today. And if you'll stop and consider just for a moment with me, that we started back there. Bill Wilson started back there alone in 1934. And then there was just one. And tonight, as I stand up here before you, there's better than 120,000 of us. And if we consider for a moment that each of our lives touched just 10 people, you add it up. 10 times 120,000. And they're growing by leaps and bounds. And we're one of the most well thought of institutions on the face of the earth. And the reason we are is that it's the only thing on the face of the earth that you get for nothing, and it isn't any good unless you go out and give it away to someone else. It's the only kind of an outfit of its kind where you don't join, you don't take any pledges, you don't sign your name to anything, you don't agree to do a thing. And that if you had $1 million, you couldn't buy entrance into that front door. And that's what makes it safe. And that's what makes some of us that have been around a while want to keep on carrying on this thing in its most simple form and pass it on to the other guy that needs it. And go out night after night, it makes no difference where, to give the other guy a lift, to help him along the way so that he may too be relieved of that suffering and that agony that we found ourselves in just a few short years back. Then this fellow said that I had to admit to God in the presence of another human being the exact nature of my wrongs, and that I had to humbly ask God to remove my shortcomings and had to become willing to have him correct my defects of character. I took those steps. I think that step is most important. In the old days down in Akron, they wouldn't even think of going into AA for any length of time until they sought out a confidant of some kind, a minister or a priest, and got with them and got this thing leveled off. Now, I don't know what you have done, or I don't know whether you have anything that's bothering you or not, but I'll tell you right straight from the shoulder that I know a lot of guys that have, and I know a lot of guys that it has made the difference between sobriety and not sobriety when they have gone and corrected this thing that's been bothering them. And it isn't hard. I know it because I did it myself. I know it because I've heard Archie tell about how he did it, and how Bill Wilson did it, and how Bob Smith did it, and how Wally Gillum and all the rest of the old-timers way down the line did it. Sure, I took all those steps. But let's take a look at the record. I hadn't been in very long until I saw quite a number of other fellows coming into this organization. And they came from all walks of life, and a lot of them was a lot worse off than I. They came from Skid Row. They'd lost everything. They didn't have a wife. They didn't have an equity in a wife. They didn't have an equity in a home. They had no place to hang their hat. And I said to myself, maybe you don't belong in here. Maybe you can go back and do a little controlled drinking. And I made a deal with myself. I got in the fall. I said, I'll stay till spring. When spring comes, I'm going up north and pitch myself a drunk, and none of the boys will know anything about it at all. I had those ideas because I thought I could go and do some controlled drinking. I thought, how nice could it be if I could go back and have a beer now and then? I'm the same guy that was so sick here a few minutes ago. I'm the same guy that took that step number one and had a burning desire to do something about this problem of mine and got to toying with the idea that maybe I could go up and take a drink. By the grace of God, and that's all that saved me. I didn't take it, but a lot of my friends have. And I'm not standing up here criticizing them because they did. But I'm trying to tell them that if some way or other that I can get it across to them that it can't be done, that I have done my duty tonight. And it can't be done. If you're once an alcoholic, you will be until the day that they put the sod on top of you. There isn't a shortcut. We can't go back and take a drink, no matter how long we've been sober. You want to know why I know? Because I have talked to innumerable men. Men that have been on a week, men that have been in a month, men 6 months, men a year. Yes, a man whose story is in that big book, who had a number of years of sobriety and decided that he could go back and do some controlled drinking, and he tried it. And I talked to him personally, and I said, how's about it? He said, no, Mike. I said, did you get any bang out of it? He said, no. I said, did you have any trouble getting back on after you got off? He said, I thought I'd never make it again. I said, where did you start in? He said, right where I left off. And I've seen so many of them. And it can't be done. And the only reason for telling this story about myself tonight or bringing this thing up is that after the fellow has tried it, and after he's found out that he can't do it, maybe there's something he's missed along the way. If he wants to call me, I'm always available. You know, this thing's a lot closer to me tonight than it was 6 months ago. Because it hasn't been very many months that I buried an awful good friend of mine and an awful good friend of Alcoholics Anonymous and an untiring worker for this cause and a fellow that had trouble. Oh, he had trouble several times. But the last stretch he had 4 years of continued sobriety started in. And he did the same thing that Mike Eshelman thought he was going to do back there 11 years ago. And he went out and took that drink. And it just took him 8 weeks. Just exactly 8 weeks before we laid him away out here in the cemetery. And he'd been around a good many years, almost 10. So if I can just leave that thought, and I believe tonight, and I believe tonight the Lord, if he did, use Danny, just to show some of us other fellows that it can't be done. Now, I'm not going to take that drink. Now, somebody says, well, I wouldn't say I'd never take a drink. I'm going to keep on saying that I'll never take a drink. Because I believe if I keep that right up here in the top of this noggin of mine, that that's a good positive thought to keep. And that with that in mind, I'm never going to take that drink. I'm scared to death of it. I know that I'm standing here tonight just one drink away from a drunk. That's all it'll take. And I know the things that'll get me to take that drink. I know that. Number one, start throwing some angles. Number two, start doing a little cheating. Number three, start doing some lying. Number four, build up that resentment and that self-pity and a lot of those other things that we people used to have. I'll throw myself in an awful short time. I know that. And I'm going to try not to do it. The best way to try not to do it is to keep yourself busy helping someone else. And this fellow said I had to make a list of everybody that I'd harmed. Become willing to make amends to them and to do so except in cases where it would injure them or others. I didn't make a written list because I didn't have enough paper. But I made a list. I worked on it. I'm still working on it. The number one man on my list is the guy that fired me from this job I'm talking to you about. He really gave me a rough time, that guy. And I'd hate to tell you some of the things that I decided to do to him. When I got around to it, they bordered on murder. You see, he wasn't too kind in this job that he did for me. He told me if I continued to get sick and didn't report so that they could send out and have somebody help me, why, I was all done, and I got sick and didn't report, and I was all done. And I'd been around this place for quite a number of years, and you gather a lot of plunder in your desk in that time. And I made a simple request to this gentleman that wouldn't he allow me to come in the next day and take my things out, or that night, rather. And he said, no, you get your things together now and get out. You know how much a drunk can hate. Mine was intense. But when I sobered up, the first thing I remembered was this. When they told me about this step, that I had to go to these people that I had harmed. I had to quit carrying this resentment. And I went and looked this fella up. I had a little trouble finding him because they fired him right shortly after he fired me. But the company for whom I worked, after they saw me sober and saw that I meant business, this same outfit that fired me, to show you what happens to you in this program, after they had seen what happened to me and saw that I meant business and they heard about it, and they knew I was sober and they knew I was trying to help other people, they invited me back up to their plant to help them celebrate the awarding of the Army and Navy E Award. And that night we had a big party down to the Statler. And they was waiting around in cocktails up to their knees down there, and I went down to that with my good wife. And I met this fella because he was invited back to help celebrate, too. And I met this fella, and I walked up to him and shook hands with him. That was a part of my program. I don't think he cared that much. He didn't care whether I shook hands with him or not, but I did. Because he didn't have any resentment against me, I guess. I don't know whether he did or not, but I did against him, and I had to lose it. And I don't think I'd have been here tonight if I hadn't have done that job, but there's, gives you an idea of the size of the job you have to do sometimes in this thing. And, of course, I've had to make restitution to other people. I'm still making it. I've still got a lifetime job out home. I'll be working on that as long as I live, and I'm having a lot of fun doing that. I've just learned since I sobered up why when you go down to a theater, you don't care much about sitting alongside of a drunk when you're looking at a double feature. You know, I used to come home after being on one of these wing dings of mine, and the little gal would leave the bedroom with her pillow under her arm, be going into the spare bedroom to sleep. She said I smelled bad. I wonder how many of you fellas that have been dry a while would like to roll in alongside of a good ripe drunk and have to sleep with him all night. That's what we asked the gals to do all the time and didn't think anything of it at all. And, of course, in this matter of restitution, I've got to a place where she can send me to the store now with a dollar bill. We've got a joint bank account again. That's some of the rewards for this thing. She can believe what I tell her. She should be able to. That's only normal. But those are the things that I've had to work on. Those are this restitution that they talk about, and it's wonderful when you do it. You won't find anyone that you walk up to that aren't overly willing to accept your apologies for whatever the thing might be. And then, of course, they tell you about this step where you have to continue to take this inventory, and when you're wrong, promptly admit it. I don't admit too easily. I've got a little story I always tell in connection with that. Some of you fellas have been around a while, heard it enough. I hope it doesn't get tiresome, but some of the new folks might throw some light on what I'm talking about. I used to live on the corner of St. Jean and Mack. I bought my shoes on Jefferson Avenue, and my blind pig was right around the corner off of Mack. And I went out one Saturday afternoon to buy a pair of shoes, and I dropped into the blind pig and got snarled up in a euchre game and got about half high before I got the shoes, and it come time to get the shoes, and I didn't have time to go to Jefferson, so I just whipped in on Mack and picked up a pair and went on home. I got home, the wife sent me down to the corner to get something else, and while I was down there, she opened the shoes, and I got back, she said to me, "Where did you buy your shoes?" And I said, "Well, I bought them on Jefferson, where I always get them." She said, "Well, that's funny, they're wrapped up in Mack Avenue paper." I said, "I don't give a damn, I got them on Jefferson anyway." We have a lot of fun at the house about that little story. I believe the next step is the most important of the 12 after you've taken the others. And that's the one where it says, we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for his will for us and the power to carry that out. That step is most powerful in this program of ours, or in anyone's daily life for that matter. Because that's the step we use when the going gets tough and we don't have the answer to these big problems that are bound to come up to all of us. That's the time when we feel that we're inadequate to meet the responsibilities of the situation as it comes. And we need some help from someone, and there isn't any help around except the help that comes from these two steps that we took back there at the beginning. And one was, we've come to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. That's the time you use this power, this God of yours. When the going gets tough and you haven't got the answer, if you'll sit still for just one moment and meditate and sincerely believe that you're going to get this help and pray to Almighty God, he'll deliver you from whatever it is. You want to know why I know? Because I've used it. Oh, it hasn't been an accident, these things that I'm going to tell you about. I told you that after, I don't know whether I told you or not, but after they threw me out of this job of mine, I went down the street and started a little ginny all my own. And I took old John Barleycorn down there with me, and we used to drink our dinners. Me out of this job of mine, I went down the street and started a little ginny all my own. And I took old John Barleycorn down there with me, and we used to drink our dinners. When I got into this deal, I didn't have anything but a lot of telephone calls from people who wanted to know when I was going to pay them the money I owed them. And the sheriff was ready to turn the key in the joint. But then I got a hold of this program, and I sobered up, and I stayed on the job, and we got some business in the place, and I got some men working for me. I guess about 25 at this time. And I come into work one morning, and all my men were out in the street. And they had a banner on their shoulder telling me that the place was on strike. And I was the whole works on the inside of this building at that time. There wasn't any board of directors or assistant superintendents or foremen or anything. I was it. And I didn't know what to do. I know what I'd have done in the old days. My saloon was just down the street a little way. I'd have went down there and got myself about a half a dozen double shots and come back and taken that place apart. Or tried to. But I didn't do that this time. Because I remember the fella got out of his home one night and brought me a program and told me about these 12 wonderful steps. And then it was this one. And then he said, when the going gets tough and you haven't got the answer, remember that you took those other two steps. And if you just ask this power that's greater than yourself to help you out of your problem, he'll see you through. Now, it might not be the answer that you want, but it'll be the best thing for you. And I knelt down in that dusty little office of mine with nothing but me and the rats in there that day and asked Almighty God for guidance. And inside of 15 minutes, those men were all back in my shop. And they haven't been out a day since, or an hour or a minute. That wasn't just an accident. You think it was? Listen to this one. I'm sitting in my office here a while back. A year and a half ago. And the secretary came in and said there was a man wanted to see me, and I said for her to show him in, and he sat down, and I asked him what I could do for him. And he said, well, I'll tell you, mister. I was discharged from Jackson Prison yesterday, and I went back to my old place of employment for my job back, and they told me I couldn't have a position there because I was an ex-convict. And he said, I was walking down Jefferson Avenue, wondering what to do, and I stopped a man over there, and I told him the same thing that I'm telling you. And he handed me this little card, and he told me to come over and see you, that you might be able to help me. And I said, sure, I'll help you. Give you a job, come into work tomorrow morning. For that, I don't want any credit. I don't deserve any. For that, I was only doing my duty. But here's the important part of this whole deal. Jefferson Avenue is a long street when you start from downtown and go out there a long way. And the point is that this man stopped the only man on Jefferson Avenue that could possibly have sent him over to me. You know why he sent him over to me? Because I never close my eyes at night that I don't thank Almighty God for the blessings that's been mine through this program and ask me to use him as his instrument to lead other fellows to this same joy and peace and contentment. That's why I've got a representative from every corrective institution in the state of Michigan. And you can start with the federal penitentiary at Milan and go right down the string. And there are men that are in AA. There are men that have seen AA in these institutions. And when they're ready for pardon and parole, it's been my great privilege, not a duty, it's been my great privilege to bring them in and work with them. And they're some of the finest men I've got. That's a part of the blessings of this deal. I wonder if you don't think that I'm just overjoyed every time I walk by this guy that brought me that little card from this fella on Jefferson Avenue, from the only man in the city of Detroit that could possibly have helped him. As the case may be, it happened to be the assistant pastor of the church that I attend. But that's answer to prayer, and oh, I've had so much of it. You know, when you talk about prayer, people think there's some mystery surrounding that. There isn't any mystery surrounding it. I've got into this thing after I did that, when they told me that I had to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, and that I had to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, and that I found out that the leader of this deal of ours had a spiritual experience there in that hospital that day 17 years ago, and he said, pass it on down the line to us fellas. I took that at face value. And I got to reading about some other fellas that weren't alcoholics big men, the biggest of our time, Henry Ford, Winston Churchill, General Eisenhower, Patton, old blood and guts Patton, the toughest soldier that ever walked in shoe leather, knew the order of common prayer by heart and never went into a battle but what he got down on his knees and did the same thing that I'm telling you about on this 12th step of our, or 11th step of ours. Then why shouldn't a common ordinary drunk use it? Sure. If it's good enough for men like that, it's good enough for me. And we don't need to be bashful or ashamed or anything about it. It's an inherent part of our birthright. Them at the boss will tell you about it. The big book will tell you about it. You know, the trouble with most of us people is that we've got all the working tools to make this thing work for us. And a lot of us don't even own the big book, let alone subscribe to our most wonderful magazine, the Grapevine. I'm not selling big books tonight. I'm not selling the Grapevine. But I'm passing on this information to you that you wouldn't, I know that if you're a plumber, you wouldn't expect to go to your job in the morning without your tools. And how can we expect to work this program unless we've got the proper tools? And one of the proper tools is the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Suppose some morning we get up and we think maybe we'd ought to take a drink. If we'll take that book and read it before we take that drink, I'll bet you all the tea in China that you won't take the drink. Because the answer's in there. The 12 steps are in there. And in those 12 steps, it tells you about this step that I'm talking about right now, where we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for His will for us and the power to carry that out. It works. And then, of course, we have the last step where it says we, having had a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to practice them in our principles in our daily lives and carry this message to other alcoholics. Of course, I'm trying to carry it tonight. It's the most important part of our program to carry it. As I said earlier in my talk, it's the only thing that I know of on the face of the earth that you get for nothing and that isn't any good unless you go out and give it to someone else. Just that simple. I think that's about all, with the exception of, I'd like to have you bear with me for just a moment. I want to do a little bragging. See Doc Green over there? He'll smile when I get through with it, but I'm going to do it anyway. You know, in the old days, when we were around drinking in these blind pigs and saloons and whatnot, and the bartender come in and he hung up his apron and he said, along about this time or a little later, he said, well, boys, I'll see you in the spring. I'm going to Florida or I'm going to California. And the weather was cold and we sat there and shake because we needed a drink or because of the weather and waiting for him to come back next spring. Well, this spring I loaded this little gal of mine in a new Cadillac, and we went west, and we were gone 8 weeks, and we saw a wonderful lot of sights. We saw Pike's Peak and the Garden of the Gods, and we saw Salt Lake City and the Royal Gorge and Bryce and Zion and the North Rim of the Canyon and Boulder Dam and Las Vegas and Los Angeles and San Diego and San Francisco and Yosemite and then we took a week and went down into Mexico and we did some deep sea fishing, the first I'd ever done in my life. And I caught three good-sized ones and we came back and I did it all on the amount of money that I saved from not drinking whiskey. Now, the hell with them guys. They can get somebody else to send them to Florida and California. I'm going myself. I'd like to leave a thought with you. It'll be a comforting thought if the going gets tough and you want something to lean on. It's about our master. It was a time when he was talking to his disciples just before this end of his came on earth. And he said, let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. And I go and prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, ye may be also. Ye know whither I go, and the way ye know. And Thomas, one of Jesus' disciples, said, Master, we know not whither thou goest. How can we know the way? And Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me. As a parting thought, be careful how you live today. You might be the only Bible that some people ever read. Thanks a lot.